From 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org, this is Take Two. I'm Amy Martinez. Thanks for being here with us. Coming up, a new report finds that staffers who work in multiple nursing homes may be the key to why the coronavirus spreads so quickly throughout these facilities despite visitor restrictions. Oh, and Quibi? Well, Quibi just quit. More on that just ahead. But first, LA City Hall is again gripped by the Me Too movement. Earlier this summer, an LAPD officer filed a lawsuit against the city claiming that he was sexually harassed by a consultant for Mayor Eric Garcetti, Rick Jacobs. In addition, the officer claimed that the mayor himself witnessed inappropriate actions by Jacobs on several occasions. And now this week, a freelance journalist alleged that Jacobs harassed him too, as well as several others, suggesting that the issue of Rick Jacobs was far more widespread. Dakota Smith has been following the story for the LA Times. Dakota, Rick Jacobs announced yesterday that he's taking a leave, but within the walls of the mayor's office, how big of a role did he play?
Jacobs is a very influential person in Garcetti's life. I think the perception is that there's Garcetti, there's Rick Jacobs, and there's Amy Wakeland, the First Lady. And those three people are really the ones that... They're very close and they have a lot of power. Obviously, it's the mayor, and Garcetti relies on Jacobs for, I think, a lot of different things, from political advice to helping, Jacobs raises money for the mayor's fund. And he is just a very influential person in Garcetti's world.
Yeah, and he's been part of that inner circle for several years, right? I mean, a long time.
Yes. So Garcetti, in 2013, when he ran for mayor, it was Jacobs who had an outside committee that raised a lot of money. And for the mayor, you'll remember he ran against Wendy Gruel. And when Garcetti won, Jacobs got a position in City Hall after that. He was deputy chief of staff, and it was a powerful position. And he stayed there until 2016, and he remains political consultant to Garcetti today.
And journalist Yashar Ali posted his firsthand account of harassment by Jacobs, and you were able to reach two other men who say they were harassed as well. What can you tell us about the kind of harassment that they say they faced?
Well, the Times found two men who say they were both subject to unwanted harassment and touching by Jacobs. One man described having his buttock squeezed by Jacobs at a party at Jacobs' house in 2012. And another man was at an event last year when he said Jacobs tried to forcibly kiss and hug him. We sent those allegations to Jacobs, who did not get back to us last night.
Now, have you been able to verify any of their accounts?
We spoke to people who either had witnessed that behavior, were actually at those events, or were told by these people that it had happened.
Now, we've reached out to the mayor's office for comment. They have not responded. What has Eric Garcetti said about the lawsuit or these more recent allegations?
Well, you'll remember that the original lawsuit by Matthew Garza, it said that Garcetti witnessed the behavior, witnessed Jacobs' harassment of this police officer. The mayor has said that he did not witness that behavior. And, of course, Jacobs also at the time has denied Garza's allegations. He said that the lawsuit was a work of pure fiction. Now, at the same time, when the lawsuit was filed, the mayor said he has zero tolerance for sexual harassment. And at the same time, he also has stood by Jacobs, basically, until yesterday, it would seem, publicly. He said that he wanted the lawsuit to go forward, but he also didn't want Jacobs to lose his positions. Then last night, there was a statement put out that Jacobs would be stepping away from his duties involving the mayor.
Talking to Dakota Smith, a City Hall reporter for the LA Times, following the story of sexual harassment allegations made against an advisor to Mayor Eric Garcetti. A couple of years ago, I remember at the height of the Me Too movement, Garcetti made a big point about stopping harassment among city workers, from the LAPD to the city council. Dakota, what's his record on tackling these kinds of issues?
Yeah, you're right. You'll remember there was the Harvey Weinstein Me Too movement, and I think that people locally also felt it acutely because there was a big uproar in Sacramento. You'll remember that all these women came forward and said that, you know, the Sacramento State Capitol was basically a toxic place for women. And Garcetti really reacted at that time, and he put in place these new reporting protocols to allow city employees to report abuse. There's never really been a good centralized system, and Garcetti said he was going to fix that. So he has cast himself as someone who is a defender of victims, for sure.
Wondering, what could the news of these allegations mean for Garcetti's political career if it's proven to be true that he was aware that harassment was going on under his watch and didn't act to stop it? I know there's talk about him possibly joining a Biden candidate, a cabinet, if Biden wins the presidency.
Yes, it's hard for me to speculate on how this will play out, but I think it's clear that Garcetti doesn't want these headlines right now in any way. He is taking a very prominent position in Biden's campaign. He's the national co-chair, and so he's doing a lot of work for the Biden campaign. He's flown to two debates, and he does not want these headlines for personal and political reasons. It's a distraction, I think the timing is not good for Garcetti right now.
And aside from the events surrounding the lawsuit by the LAPD officer, will there be an independent investigation? Is anyone prominent calling for one?
Right now, there isn't. I had previously asked the mayor's office if there would be an HR investigation or any sort of internal investigation, and there isn't. And I'm not entirely sure why that is, but I believe the answer back was that, you know, this lawsuit is going forward and Jacobs does not work at the city anymore, even though he does work at the Mayor's Fund, which, of course, is that nonprofit that helps raise money for city programs.
And just to be clear, really quick, Dakota, nothing will change with Mayor Garcetti's duties at City Hall. Everything's still going to be on schedule, whatever it is that he has going on this week and in the coming weeks.
You mean in terms of these allegations?
Yeah.
The coronavirus has made it so strange that he's rarely sort of seen in public. Like everyone else, he's hunkered down. I know he's been, you know, working at City Hall in past weeks, and I presume out of the Getty House, okay, his official residence. I don't know what his schedule is like this week. And I don't know what sort of work he's doing for the Biden campaign, what his schedule.
That's Dakota Smith, City Hall reporter for the LA Times. Dakota, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, moving on. Nursing homes have been devastated by the coronavirus. In California alone, more than 5,800 residents and staff of nursing homes and other long-term care facilities have died from COVID-19. Nationally, the number is more than 84,000 deaths. Now, a new study finds that people who work at multiple nursing homes may help spread the virus. However, limiting health workers' jobs could hurt the labor pool that nursing homes rely on. KPCC's Jackie Fortier reports.
Martha Tapia works at two different nursing homes in Orange County, and she worries about bringing the coronavirus home to her granddaughter.
I start to work at 7 and I finish at 11.
That's 7 in the morning to 11 o'clock at night. Tapia is almost 60 and she works 64 hours a week. She's one of thousands of certified nursing assistants, predominantly women of color, who bathe, dress, and feed the nation's fragile elderly.
We do everything for them.
At the nursing home where she works in the morning, she gets an N95 mask that she has to reuse and leave there. At her other nursing home job in the afternoons, she only gets a blue surgical mask.
They say they cannot give us N95.
Tapia tries to protect herself by buying her own N95 masks. She doesn't want to work at multiple nursing homes, but her Southern California rent is $2,200 a month.
I don't want to get sick, but we need to work. We need to eat. We need to pay rent.
In March, when the coronavirus was racing through nursing homes, the federal government banned visitors. But coronavirus infections kept spreading. UCLA professor Keith Chen tried to figure out why.
The people who we can infer work in this nursing home, what other nursing homes do they work at?
Chen's study used anonymous cell phone data to help see the movements of people into and out of nursing homes. The data showed a lot of nursing home workers are, like Martha, working at more than one.
When you learn that over 20 of your workers are also spending time in other nursing homes, that should be a real red flag.
Chen and his team found that on average, each nursing home is connected to seven others. They also found the more shared workers a nursing home had, the more COVID-19 infections among the patients. UCLA professor Elisa Long also worked on the study.
There are some facilities in Florida, in New Jersey, where they're sharing upwards of 50 to 100 workers. Again, this is over an 11-week time period, but that's a huge number of individuals that are moving between these facilities. All of these are potential sources of COVID transmission.
The California Association of Health Facilities represents most nursing homes in the state. In response to the study, the group said they can't prevent workers like Martha Tapia from taking jobs elsewhere, and they can't pay them more because California doesn't pay them enough through Medicaid. But Mike Dark doesn't buy that argument. He's an attorney that works on nursing home reform, and he says the state already tried paying nursing homes more in 2006.
That money tends to go into the pockets of the executives and the administrators who run these places.
Instead, he says regulators need to focus on the basics, especially in the hundreds of California nursing homes with ongoing outbreaks.
Right now, there's poor access to PPE. There is still erratic compliance with things like hand washing requirements.
And it's not just patients who are at risk. Nursing home workers like Martha Tapia are also contracting COVID-19. In California alone, 152 of them have died since the pandemic began. Covering health, I'm Jackie Fortier.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC, and you can get the Take 2 podcast on Apple Podcasts. I'm E. Martinez. If your annual holiday tradition involves watching Peanuts specials, well, you won't find them on broadcast TV this year. And could movie theaters get a bailout from the government? For this and more, it's time for our weekly segment, On the Lot.
Stick your head out and yell.
You want a chocolate?
All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
Rebecca Keegan is here, senior editor for film for The Hollywood Reporter. And Rebecca, let's start with Quibi. It was just 2 months ago that this streaming service launched with Jeffrey Katzenberg, Meg Whitman, and a whole bunch of big-name talent behind it, and also $1.75 billion that it raised. And now it is shutting down. I mean, that was quick, Rebecca. So catch us up on Quibi.
Quibi actually launched about 7 months ago. Easy to forget, though, because it launched in the very earliest weeks of the pandemic in April of 2020. And it was all about short form content tailored for phones, which was based on the premise that people would watch these things when they were out of their homes. Launching in April meant, of course, that nobody was allowed to go anywhere, which really stressed their business model. Since then, Jeffrey Katzenberg has been trying to sell Quibi to companies like Facebook and NBC and had no luck. According to the Wall Street Journal today, Katzenberg has started calling investors to tell him he's shutting the service down.
Wow. All right. So what's going to happen to Quibi's content then? I mean, if he's trying to sell it and no one's buying, I mean, what, it just sits there?
Right. Well, one of the things that was unusual about Quibi was that it was offering creators the opportunity to own their own content after just 2 years, which is probably part of what made prospective buyers of the company uninterested. You're going to own this content for what, you know, 18 months. But a lot of this is unclear as this potential shutting down of the company is unfolding.
Now, it's an expensive lesson, but I'm wondering what lesson, if any, can Hollywood learn from Quibi's very short life?
Well, in some ways, they suffered from really the worst timing possible in trying to launch during the pandemic. But there were other problems. I mean, one of them was that there was never really a breakout must-see show like Netflix had House of Cards. There was nothing that everybody was talking about saying, you have to subscribe to Quibi just to see this. And they were slow to adjust to some other sort of technical things too, which may have helped shows become viral, like allowing people to capture and share screen grabs in the app.
I mean, that's what the kids do, Rebecca. That's what the kids do.
That is what the kids do. Yes, do. You're right.
Yeah. All right. Now, speaking of streaming services, Netflix did not meet Wall Street expectations with its subscriber numbers. Rebecca, what happened? I mean, all any of us are doing is watching streaming TV. So what happened with Netflix?
Right. It has seemed like Netflix has been one of the major winners of the pandemic, such as there are any winners. And they did still gain subscribers, about 2 million in this most recent quarter, but that's less than the 3 million analysts were expecting. It may have been inevitable because of the enormous numbers of new subscribers the company picked up in the first months of the pandemic. They gained 10 million new subscribers in the second quarter. I don't think anyone expected that pace to continue.
So one can imagine then that subscribers will level off despite many of us being housebound. But what does that actually really mean for Netflix? I mean, is this a bad thing?
Well, analysts are still calling Netflix a buy stock because they shared some encouraging information about their financials. They're relying less on debt to finance their content now, which is clearly good when it comes to the long-term health of the company.
Wait, Netflix shared information about itself?
Right. Only the kind it's obligated to share.
Oh, okay. So also at Netflix, several top executives have left. So what's going on at the top of Netflix?
Well, the company restructured its TV business recently to make it more globally focused. And in the process, they let go Cindy Holland, who had been a major figure at Netflix, I think the longest serving creative executive after Ted Sarandos, as well as some other executives. CEO Reed Hastings said that they applied what they called the, quote, keeper test to these folks who recently departed the company, which is this idea at Netflix of asking yourself, would you keep an employee if they wanted to leave the company?
Have you ever heard of this before, Rebecca?
The keeper test? Well, Reed Hastings talks about it in his book, but I'll be honest, I've mostly heard people use it, applying it to their relationships rather than, you know, the workplace.
I know. That's probably where it started, I guess. Yeah. All right. So time is ticking on a deadline to get some movement on a congressional aid package, and movie theater owners are really counting the minutes down. What could be in it for them if another aid package is approved?
Well, theaters have lobbied to get themselves included in this COVID relief bill that Congress is debating, which would allow them to tap into federal funding to stay afloat in these times when theaters in places like here in LA and New York City are closed and when studios are holding back their biggest films.
If they get federal funds, Rebecca, you don't think popcorn should go down like a buck or two, right, for a big bag? They can't keep charging $20 for a bag of popcorn at that point, could they?
Good question. Yeah, I don't know how the federal aid would apply to my junior mint budget, but the reality is that these companies really are struggling. According to the National Association of Theater Owners, they say that without this aid, 70% of the theaters in the country could file for bankruptcy or close permanently by the end of the year. And more than 70,000 jobs could be lost permanently. AMC is saying it could run out of cash by the end of the year, and Regal, as we've talked about on the show, is already closed.
You know, we've been talking about this all summer, Rebecca, now into the fall. I mean, I won't go to movie theaters. I just won't. I'm not comfortable. But then, yeah, if when I'm finally ready to go in a movie theater, they might not be there for me to go into.
Right. I mean, this is the dilemma that the studios have had, is wanting to encourage and support this business that's integral to theirs. At the same time, we saw Warner Brothers roll out Tenet, the Chris Nolan film, which really, I mean, I think it's made about $50 million domestically off a $200 million production budget. It just sort of showed that even with a big, splashy new Hollywood movie in theaters, so many theaters are still closed and so many people are still fearful about going that it is just not possible for studios to bring their biggest movies out in this environment.
All right. Finally today, Rebecca, so I'm hearing that Charlie Brown specials will no longer be on broadcast television, on free broadcast television this holiday season. That can't be true. Say it ain't so, yeah. Rebecca Keegan.
Yeah, for the first time ever, you're going to need Wi-Fi to watch The Great Pumpkin. I know it's hard to process, but Apple has picked up the rights to the Peanuts holiday specials for their streaming service, Apple TV+. The company will make the three holiday specials accessible for free for a few days around Halloween, Thanksgiving, and Christmas. But yeah, you're going to need a smart TV or a Roku or something to watch them beyond just your old-fashioned TV.
Yeah, so not everyone then can automatically just jump to subscribe to the streaming service and get these specials. So there are some hurdles to it's almost like Lucy has the football, and and everyone is running to go kick the football, and it's being pulled away.
Yeah, I mean, I think in some ways it's a very smart strategy by Apple. It's another kind of piece of beloved content that will presumably lure people to try out their streaming service and they hope stick around.
Really quick, Rebecca, which one is your favorite Charlie Brown special?
The jazz piano in the Christmas special, the score of the Christmas special is basically the audio equivalent of a hug. So I'm going to go with that one. I think we need that in 2020.
I used to know them all, but then once I realized that during the holidays there's football on TV, that's when I left Charlie Brown behind for football.
Time to come back.
I'm just a sports jerk, I know. That's Rebecca Keegan, senior film editor at The Hollywood Reporter. Rebecca, thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and online at kpcc.org. I'm E. Martinez. The world of podcasts seemed to be ever-expanding, and each week we talk with a guy who's tracking all of it. Nick Kwa is the host of the LA Studios podcast about the podcast industry called Servant of Pod. And this week, we get into a new venture that may have ramifications for locally produced shows here in LA. And did you know there's QAnon content on Apple Podcasts? Not a conspiracy theory. That is real. So, Nick, in addition to your LA Studio podcast, you've got a newsletter, Hot Pod, and in it, we read that there's this new company that's all about local voices. So what's the story there?
Yeah, so there's this guy, David Plotz, who's pretty well known in the podcast and media world. He's the former editor-in-chief of Slate, which has this huge podcast network. He's also the longtime co-host of the Slate Political Gabfest, which is a really popular podcast. And most recently, he was the CEO of Atlas Obscura, a travel media company. So this week, he announced that he's launching a company called CityCast, which he describes as primarily being a network of daily news podcasts that specifically serve cities across the country. So he's really interested in working on the problem of local news, of local media, which you probably know this has been on the decline over the past two decades or so with the rise of the internet. And he's building a company that's hoping to help alleviate the problems there.
So is he partnering with local podcast creators and companies to distribute under the banner of CityCast, or is this a production company?
The intent is to hire podcast talent to serve as the voices of specific city that will be served by CityCast. So it's one company, a bunch of shows, and each of those shows like serves a different city. And he talks about the position of those talents as being like an evolution of like the newspaper columnist or the TV personality back in the heyday of local media. You know, people who serve as like avatars of that city almost. They're people who are passionate about their city, they're passionate about local civics, and they want to give voice to it.
Nick, you're the expert. I mean, what do you make of this company idea? I mean, is there a need for it?
I am personally like really interested and invested in the problem of local media. Like I'm one of those people who really believes that the death of local newspapers have contributed to the fracturing of American society. But of course, CityCast is a startup and ideas are cheap. And so everything depends on whether Plotz is able to graduate from an idea to an actual business.
There's another issue you mentioned in the newsletter, QAnon on pods. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so there was a post by Media Matters recently, and Media Matters is the, I guess you could call them like a left-leaning media watchdog organization. They noted that they've been observing some QAnon personalities moving to other platforms after YouTube laid down a ban on their content recently. I think that happened just a few days ago. One of those platforms that they're migrating onto is podcasting. And I should say that this isn't the first time we've seen conspiracy theory entities in the podcast ecosystem. We saw a bunch of those pop up during the early days of the pandemic, spreading all kinds of disinformation. This just seems to be a continuation of that trend, tying together with QAnon, which is this like increasingly prominent political conspiracy theory. It's very alarming. This will be a really hard problem to deal with for podcasting, which has been, you know, defined for a long time by their open publishing ethos. You know, anybody can publish. I'm not quite sure how this is going to shake out, but a big part it will involve seeing what the big platforms will do, in particular Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
We're talking to Nick Kwa. He hosts the LAS Studios podcast about podcasts, Servant of Pod. All right, so let's get to your podcast. This week's episode is about the music history podcast, Lost Notes, produced at our sister station across town, KCRW. Nick, there seems to be a loose podcast genre of revisiting unknown or forgotten history. And I'm thinking of Malcolm Gladwell's Revisionist History and NPR's Throughline. So would you put Lost Notes in that genre?
I would not necessarily put Lost Notes in a category because the show isn't quite structured as a show that subverts anything you might know about the past. It's now in its third season. It mostly just unearths great stories about music history and the music world and the music industry from the past. And they just sort of tell them in these straightforward, interesting, and beautiful ways. And in this season, which just came out a couple of weeks ago in its entirety, it's hosted by the poet critic Hanif Abdurraqib. All of its episodes has to do with the year 1980.
Okay, so what stories is Hanif telling in the new season of Lost Notes?
The whole season has 7 episodes in total. There are general loose themes about sort of lost legacy, how we remember certain people, and sort of in that general direction. There's an episode about the disco legend Grace Jones and about how her art navigated the anti-disco sentiment that was rising as we rolled into the 80s. There's an episode about the context of Stevie Wonder's rendition of Happy Birthday, which came out of a comeback album. So each episode stands alone, and they're told in this really gorgeous essayistic kind of style. It's very natural to Abdurraqib, who, by the way, is a fantastic writer. He wrote this amazing book in 2019 called Go Ahead in the Rain, which is about his love for a tribe called Quest. And there's a bunch of similar qualities between the two projects, but Hanif is probably more known as a poet. And I asked him in the interview if he found any differences in the working style writing for a podcast versus writing for poetry.
For me, poetry is a sonic, like writing is a sonic practice. And if we're lucky, if I'm lucky and I get in a good groove, then I am writing for the ear always, or I'm writing with an understanding that the language is a vehicle through which music can be carried. That felt a little challenging, perhaps, as the pieces got longer. You know, I mean, it bears mentioning that the format of Lost Notes 1980 was going to be that we had people kind of dropping in and doing interviews and kind of this like thing where I was not the sole voice in most of them. But, you know, COVID happened here in March when we were just getting down to recording. And so recording studios closed and it was kind of like, well, I guess you're just writing these kind of audio essays now, you know.
So what's an example of one of the audio essays in this season?
Yeah, so to clarify a little bit, all of the episodes of Lost in 1980 are basically audio essays. And one example is there's an episode about the relationship between the death of Darby Crash and the death of John Lennon. Darby Crash is this really well-known punk singer, kind of lived a very brief, short career in life. And Hanif kind of weaves his story, just telling it straightforward. There are no quotes. He just sort of describes it as an omniscient narrator, and it flows in such a gorgeous way.
But Darby Crash died on December 7th, 1980. By the time the news of his death began to circulate, it was well into December 8th. While Mark David Chapman paced outside of John Lennon's apartment with a record, Darby Crash was being pulled, lifeless, from a house. While word was spreading around the LA punk scene about Crash's death, Lennon was signing his name on his eventual killer's record. And while radio stations in Los Angeles began to start their marathon of germ songs, John Lennon lay dying in New York at the doorway to his apartment. News and radio stations broke away to deliver what must have seemed like a larger, more urgent heartbreak.
On some episodes, they even do this thing where they run the main audio essay and then they kind of add on a long form interview afterwards, almost like fact checking the things that were sort of described in the essays.
That's Nick Kwa. He writes the Hot Pod newsletter, also hosts the LA Studios podcast about podcasts called Servant of Pod. You can find it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you like to listen. Nick, thanks a lot.
Thank you.